51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. We woke this morning to the very sad news for fans of movies and music around the world. The death at the age of 91 of Ennio Morricone, one of the true greats of film composition. In a career spanning six decades, he composed music for over 400 films, including The Mission, Cinema Paradiso and Bugsy. His first Oscar for an original score, however, came as recently as 2015 with Quentin Tarantino's Western, The Hateful Eight. But for many, his scores for the Western movies directed by Sergio Leone in the 1960s are amongst the most groundbreaking and most memorable of his compositions. Theme there from the 1966 Sergio Leone movie The Good, the Bad and the Ugly, with music of course from the great Ennio Morricone, whose death was announced this morning. Joining me on the phone this evening, musician David Agnew and cultural historian Sir Christopher Frayling to discuss Morricone's legacy. You met Morricone and have interviewed him on a number of occasions, I believe, Christopher. When did you first get to know him? It was through Sergio Leone, in fact, and his films.
It was through the Leone family. I was writing Leone's biography, and obviously Morricone played a huge part in it. And so the Leone family in Rome introduced me to Morricone. But everybody warned me that you must absolutely not mention the phrase spaghetti westerns to Morricone. It was absolutely forbidden when you were talking to him. He thought the phrase was a put down and rather sort of denigratory to the work of a composer. I personally think the phrase spaghetti westerns is a term of endearment, but he didn't see it like that. So I had a great warning: don't mention the spaghetti. And that said, he was very, very helpful and had a very, very close working relationship with Leone. They were in fact at the same primary school together in the 1930s, Sergio Leone and Ennio Morricone. And they hadn't really kept in touch in between, but when they re-met in the mid-60s, they realized that they had so much in common. And they were completely in sync, to the point where in the fourth of Leone's westerns, Once Upon a Time in the West, the music was entirely written before the movie was even shot. And so they recorded it, played it on the set with an open reel tape recorder, with a PA system, so all the actors could hear it. And, you know, they understood each other so well that all the themes, the words, the performances were distilled into the music even before they made the movie. And that's almost unique, I think.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary reality that was the way that they composed their music. Of course, the normal situation would be that the film is made and the music is cut and measured and timed to fit the scenes that the director and the editor have given us as something close to a final product. But Leone himself said that 40% of any film is the music. So was that particular relationship between Morricone and Leone, was it very different from his relationship with other film directors?
Well, he always said that Leone, and also the director, you mentioned Cinema Paradiso, the director of Cinema Paradiso, Tornatore, were two directors who understood how to make music breathe. You know, a lot of people chop music around, or as you say, do it with a stopwatch. It's all very tight. But those two directors, he said, they had a way of letting the music breathe. So you had an entire sequence, which was music and image with hardly any words. So almost like a rock video, only I think at a deeper level than that. So it's this thing of just giving the music its head, giving it an opportunity to shine in the movie, rather than simply making it sort of Mickey Mouse music, where you're just illustrating what's going on the screen. So the music takes on a life of its own. And I think Morricone's favorite example of that was the scene in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, where Eli Wallach is rushing around a cemetery, a military cemetery, and there's a theme called The Ecstasy of Gold that plays, which is basically four notes, bong, 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 repeated over and over again in different orchestrations. And it's 3 minutes and 20 seconds. And for me, it's the greatest piece of film music ever, ever recorded. And that was, in fact, recorded before they shot the sequence. The sequence was cut and edited and performed to the music. And it really, you can't think of that sequence without thinking about the music, letting the music breathe.
There is an extraordinary, I'll take David Agnew in at this point. David, there is an extraordinary story. You heard this story yourself on the stage of the National Concert Hall when David Putnam was being interviewed there. And it's around The Mission, and of course a piece that lots of people in this country associate you with, Gabriel's Oboe. But the extraordinary thing here is, there is a scene of it is Jeremy Irons playing the oboe in the film, if I remember correctly. But what he's miming to, you might expect Morricone would have had the piece ready to go, but he was really wary about that piece because Putnam had presented him with a piece of 18th century oboe music by a composer called Alessandro Marcello, famous oboe composer, and Morricone just didn't. He said, "I can't improve upon that. How dare I even approach it?"
Well, good evening. Well, as an oboe player, of course, I'm indebted to Ennio Morricone for Gabriel's Oboe. But the story he told was that he had a habit of using contemporary classical music to evoke the mood in certain scenes, and he'd want the music then written after that. And he was using this slow movement from the Marcello Oboe Concerto that Johann Sebastian Bach had done a transcription of for harpsichord and put in all these very elaborate ornaments. And he played this for Ennio Morricone, and he said, I want a piece like that. And Morricone said, "I'm sorry, but I can't improve on it. That to me is the most one of the most perfect pieces of music ever written." And Putnam got quite shirty and said, "Well, we can't be nominated for an Oscar unless the music is original. So go away and do something." And he went away and came back with Gabriel's Oboe, which to me is the most perfect piece of contemporary oboe music ever written. It's as oboe players, we've only ever had Swan Lake and The Duck in Peter and the Wolf by Prokofiev, and every other piece was 200 years old. So it's short, it's 2.5 minutes long. It's a standalone piece that breaks your heart and puts you back together again before the end of it. So, and it's one of those pieces that you can indulge your own personal internal conflicts and assimilate. So it's good for happy occasions, sad occasions. It's just an absolutely incredible piece.
This is you playing. Can say is that the slow movement to the Marcello Oboe Concerto must be quite amazing if that is not an improvement upon it. Gabriel's Oboe, played there by David Agnew. That's the famous recording, very successful for yourself and Frank McNamara back in 1989. How long did it spend at the top of the charts here at home, David?
Well, it was quite a surprise. We were 5 weeks in the Irish top 20. We got up as far as number 8, but there was an advertising agency had used us as a backdrop to an Aer Lingus ad, and they had paid a huge amount of money to license it for the year, and their time was running out. And Gay Byrne, ironically enough, on the Late Late Show had raved about it, and his name was Gabriel, and of course Frank McNamara at the time was the musical director of the show. So we went away and recorded it, and we got an opportunity to play it, and it started my recording career, certainly as an oboe. So I'm totally indebted to the piece that's brought me all over the world.
It does.
And of course, I played for the funeral of Ray McAnally.
Yes.
At the time, who was the cardinal in the Mid Film Division.
Yeah, and you played that piece, yeah.
I've had a great association with it over the years.
One of the things that piece shows us, Christopher Frayling, is this ability that, now I'm not sure if it was exactly the Morricone orchestrations that David and Frank McNamara were using there, but it does show that Morricone himself could take what is a single line melody and build around it in the most extraordinary way, a kind of texture of orchestra.
Yeah, that was very much his thing. I mean, he was an amazing melodist, I think. He had these wonderful, almost childlike melodies sometimes. And then he'd repeat them, and they'd build up, as you say, and sometimes the human voice. Quite a lot of his scores are choral. And he once said to me that actually The Mission was probably his favorite complete score, that, as he put it, I recognized myself both technically and spiritually in that score. He was a very devout Catholic and saw the music in The Mission as three different musics, he said. There's the music of the Jesuits, the Jesuit missionaries. There's the music of the Counter-Reformation, the post-Council of Trent, Palestrina, and all these people who are trying to work out theologically what they can do with music. And there's the music of the Paraguayan Indians. And these three musics are sort of colliding throughout the movie. He said, really, the movie is about music, about the spiritual power of music. And it finishes with famously with a broken violin floating down a river. You know, the whole thing is really that, you know, these politicians and missionaries come and go, but the music survives. And he felt that was saying something very important. And as you say, it's a very characteristic thing. He went on a seminar with John Cage, the avant-garde American composer, in 1958. And he said he learned from that, one, how to use pauses, that pauses are very important. Mm. Secondly, how to do unusual orchestrations that you put into the mix, all sorts of things that the audience doesn't expect. And thirdly, you use natural sounds, not in The Mission, but if you take his Western scores, where he's got anvils and whip cracks and grunting noises and shrieks and all these things, and he's putting natural sounds into the mix and treating them as kinds of music. He said he learned that from John Cage. So that there's all sorts of, you know, serious avant-garde roots in this music, I think.
Yeah, because let's listen to a little bit at the opening of Once Upon a Time in the West, which you might think is a Foley artist at play here, but this is Morricone. I'll play this underneath, and you might explain. He had been to an avant-garde concert, I think, and came back to Sergio Leone with the idea of this opening sequence, very famous opening sequence.
That's
Can
right.
you hear it there?
He wrote a theme, actually, for the opening sequence, which is three bad guys waiting at the station, and the train is 2 hours late, so they're bored out of their skulls, they don't know what to do, and they just want to shoot somebody. and so they're waiting, and they had this music written, and Morricone went to a concert in Florence, which consisted of a performance artist with a metal ladder, which he held against a microphone, heavily amplified, and did a sort of symphony for metal ladder for 20 minutes, a piece of very avant-garde performance music. And that night, Morricone phoned Leone and said, look, why don't we just construct the sequence out of amplified natural sounds, isolated and out of context, a squeaky windmill, as we've just heard, a fly buzzing, a ticker tape going, a door squeaking, and we'll do a kind of symphony of natural sounds to create the tension. And he said, it's the best piece of music I never wrote.
Just listen to it again. Extraordinary that the man who gave us that melody in Gabriel's Oboe could equally give us this. But that is what he was doing. He was composing for film. He dismissed Christopher, I think, at one point when you said to him, 400 films, that's a lot of music. He kind of dismissed it as he was in the Halfpenny Place.
I said to him, 400 films for 150 directors, 500 arrangements of popular songs, which he did throughout the 1950s. If you've got a Mario Lanza record somewhere, the likelihood is that Morricone arranged it. 100 concert pieces, sonatas, concertos, cantatas. I said, you know, if you do the maths, I mean, you can't have had any free time for the last 40 years. And he paused and said, compared to Bach, I was practically unemployed. that Bach had to produce a piece of sacred music every Sunday when he was working in these churches in Germany. He said, I didn't have to do it every week, you know. And sometimes these scores wait around for a year or two before they actually come out. So it's difficult to judge which year he actually wrote them in. But 400, my goodness me. Yeah. He was a very diligent. He was famously conscientious. And in his apartment in Rome, in the Piazza Venezia, which I visited once to interview him, there was this metal door, which was the door to his studio. And absolutely nobody was allowed in there. Not the cleaning lady, not his wife, not his children, his boys or his girl, his daughter. They weren't allowed in because what he used to do was he orchestrated as he composed. He said, for him, orchestration and composing are part of the same continuum. So he would have in front of him some 32-stave manuscript paper. Now, this, imagine this, 32-stave manuscript paper, no piano in that room. Out of his head, in pencil, he orchestrated the entire thing straight onto the page. And that's how he composed. Yeah. But nobody was allowed in there to blow the dust off it.
Well, you can imagine why he wanted to keep that to himself for a little while. David Agnew, that is an extraordinary facility for any composer to be able to do, to work in that fashion. Are there other, obviously Gabriel Zoba has a very personal connection to you, David. Are there other scores that stand out for you, film scores of Morricone's?
Well, yes, of course. I mean, Cinema Paradiso. I mean, you know, Gabriel Zoba wouldn't be my go-to piece because you have to deliver it for people who are listening. But, you know, Cinema Paradiso is just absolutely exquisite. There's others like La Califa and For Love One Can Die. And I would have my own, you know, go-to pieces. The Once Upon a Time in America, Deborah's theme, just absolutely just extraordinary. So they'd be my personal favourites.
I want to play a little bit of his music for My Name Is Nobody. You might explain to us, Christopher.
Yeah.
It's a little bit into this piece, and I'll bring it up when they appear.
Yeah.
I mean, the usual sounds are there at the beginning. Let me just listen to the beginning. You know, the whistling is there, the guitar is there. It sounds like, yeah. I won't use the word the pasta shape for fear he's listening to me from elsewhere. It has all of the themes that you might, or the motifs that you might expect, but then it goes into an extraordinary place later on. What was this compositional?
Well, this is the thing. He was saying to me that he told me about his time with John Cage, and I said, was there a direct connection between your avant-garde experiments with John Cage and your scores, particularly in the Westerns? And he said, no, I don't think so. I said, well, how about My Name Is Nobody, where you rearranged The Ride of the Valkyries by Wagner for car hooters, for
car horns. Here we have it. I really don't know where that comes from.
I said, you know, I mean, anybody who can rearrange The Ride of the Valkyries for car hooters must have been influenced by John Cage. He said, I'll give you that one.
Yeah. Finally, for you, David Agnew, then, I know that you attended the 75th birthday commemoration, the concert in the Royal Albert Hall, which indeed, Christopher introduced Ennio Morricone. What was the live experience like?
Well, it's kind of curious because the audience is full of a lot of couples, and when their own particular favourite piece of music would come along, you could see them nudging each other. But the live experience for me was curious because it was like a smorgasbord of all his popular pieces, everything he'd written, and you felt that he kind of delivered those because people expected them, but he indulged himself in lesser known pieces that would be dotted throughout the concert because I don't know, maybe he was attached to those himself personally.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because there were compositions for that were non-film compositions, which obviously didn't have the same popularity. But what would you, as we finish up, because I do want to finish with the love theme from Cinema Paradiso, which I know he didn't like himself. He didn't think it was great. Most people love it. I do, and I'm sure you both listening will as well. What is his legacy, Christopher Frayling, Ennio Morricone?
Well, I think he came out of classical music. He was a great orchestrator. He was a great melodist. I think he transcended film. He was a great composer, period. He always felt that the music establishment didn't rate him highly enough, and that he wasn't treated as in the first 11, as it were, of composers in Italy. And I said, more fool them, because frankly, you know, you're one of the great composers of the mid-20th century, and they should realize it. So I think he's not just a great composer, not a great film composer, he's a great composer as well. And very, very innovative. The use of the human voice, the orchestrations, some of the great melodies, and some of the great relationships between director and composer, you know, like Bernard Herrmann and Alfred Hitchcock, or Nino Rota and Fellini. I think the relationship between Leone and Morricone was one of the greatest director-composer relationships in the history of the movies.
We'll finish up with the love theme from Cinema Paradiso. Christopher Frayling and David Agnew, thanks for being with us this evening. Last notes to Ennio Morricone.
28 minutes past seven on Monday night's Arena, and Monday nights means it's time for our European City Break series, where we travel absolutely safely and without fear of COVID-19, because we are travelling by novel. Last week, Mary McGill showed us Amsterdam through its golden age of art in her book Choices. Tonight we're off to Berlin with Richard Aldous, and three novels from three different decades, one from the 1960s, one from the 1990s, and the most recent from the end of the noughties. And Richard Aldous joins me now from New York, in fact. But when we spoke to you first about this series, Richard, Berlin was the immediate choice. There was no doubt in your mind. Do you have a particular relationship with that city?
It's a city that I love, Sean. I love to visit, but also as a historian, it's so central to the 20th century experience, whether it's in the early part of the century with Hitler and Nazism, but even more so in some ways with the Cold War and the way in which the Berlin Wall represents everything about that conflict. So it's a city which has captured the historical imagination as well as the literary one, I think.
And does it capture the imagination pre-World War II in the same way as it does post-World War II, which is where you have chosen from the period from which you've chosen your three novels?
I think that it does, obviously, because of that it's so closely connected with Hitler and Nazism, but also the First World War as well. So, but there is something very visceral, I think, about the wall and the way in which that symbolizes the conflict during the Cold War, when, of course, everything was so dangerous because of nuclear weapons. So there was always that fear with the Cold War and Berlin that conflict, that something happening in that city would bring about some kind of nuclear confrontation.
And quite definitely that is what is there in the first choice that you have for us from 1963. The wall is just up, in fact, in the case of this book. One of the greatest spy novels ever written is what you say, and I think many people will agree with you. Tell us what that first choice is and why.
Yeah, it's John le Carré's The Spy Who Came in from the Cold. And as you say, I mean, it really is one of the greatest spy novels ever written. It kind of begins and ends at the Berlin Wall. Obviously, I'm not going to give away what happens at the end. But he really captures the kind of grittiness, the real sense of division that the wall represents. But he also uses it kind of very cleverly to represent the moral ambiguity, which he really brings out in his novels. Many of his critics describe this as a moral equivalence between East and West. But of course, it contrasts with the generation earlier. The first James Bond novel came out in 1953, so 10 years before this book. And the character of Alec Lemus in this book by Le Carré and the character of James Bond really couldn't be any different. That Lemus is a kind of very seedy character. He's burnt out, he's disillusioned, he doesn't really have any kind of sense of the glamour or the style or even the vodka martinis of James Bond.
Given that sceniness and, as you say, the absence of style perhaps that Lemus has, how does Le Carré achieve the ambiguity, the moral ambiguity and the kind of the difficult decisions that Lemus either half makes or doesn't make?
Yeah, he does it in a number of ways, actually. First of all, he introduces a character called Liz Gold in the novel. She's actually given a different name in the famous film. But Liz Gold represents idealism. She speaks from the heart. She's very committed to what she does. And he upbraids her to kind of towards the end, again, without giving away what happens, you know, where he says to her, well, what do you think that spies are? That, you know, we're not measuring things against God or Karl Marx. We're just a kind of bunch of seedy, squalid so-and-so. In fact, he uses much stronger language than that. But this kind of sense of the kind of the seediness, the lack of morality, the kind of ethical balance between East and West, which has completely been blown away for Alec by the relationship that he has with this young woman, Liz Gold.
And Le Carré himself, of course, involved in the whole spy trade. How important is that to his ability to write novels in general, but particularly this novel? How did it help, do you think?
Yes, it's interesting, Sean, isn't it? Because there's no question about it that because Le Carré was involved with both MI5 and MI6, the kind of novel is kind of suffused with this kind of sense of reality, of knowing what he was talking about. Ian Fleming with the James Bond novels kind of played on the same kind of idea, that because Fleming had been involved with naval intelligence during the war. So, you know, you read these things and they have that kind of that air of reality about them. They feel as if they're written from the inside. And interestingly, there's a new work of history by Simon Ball called Secret History, which has just been written about this. And he shows how Le Carré and Fleming, they actually use the style that MI5 and MI6 use to write their own case histories. So there really is a kind of a sense of continuity between the real spies writing about what happened and Le Carré and Fleming and these people writing about it in these fictional works.
Are you telling me that there are some great stylists in MI5 and that we should all get in there and rifle the files to entertain ourselves?
It is actually. I mean, it's we laugh about it in kind of some ways. When you go back, for example, when you read the official histories and the case histories of something like Enigma, cracking the Enigma code, Bletchley Park, they are fantastically written. They're beautifully written, historically impeccable, because the thing that they actually want with those histories is to record what actually happened, because then they can draw on it later. It's not actually in their interest to kind of corrupt what happened, because then it's no use to them later on.
How frightening a place is the Berlin that John le Carré gives us in The Spy Who Came In from the Cold?
It's terrifying, isn't it? I mean, it really does capture not just the seediness of the kind of the spy world, but the real sense of danger. I mean, I was very struck, actually, when I was listening to Colm Tobin talking about Venice, and he made the point to you that, you know, maps really don't make any difference in Venice. You know, you just kind of, you end up, you go down the wrong street, is kind of thing, kind of so on. But in Berlin in the 1960s, it's the complete opposite. You did not want to find yourself in the wrong sector. The wall defined those maps. Everything is very clearly kind of laid out. So it's almost the opposite kind of experience to that Venetian one that he's describing.
The physical Berlin that he describes then is very much, is it dictated by that, the nature of whatever part of the city you are in and the politics of that part of the city?
Yeah, very much so. And really, the whole novel is about the transition from West Berlin to East Berlin and East Berlin to West Berlin. So he has a number of these set pieces in the book that are incredibly dramatic, very tense, for particularly, you know, when the one that happens towards the end is just spine tingling as you see these characters trying to negotiate that transition.
Now, if the Berlin of John le Carré's The Spy Who Came In from the Cold is a frightening place, it's not remotely as frightening as the place that Robert Harris gives us in his 1992 novel Fatherland, which is your second choice for us this evening, Richard Aldous, bringing us to Berlin by book. An alternative history. We're in 1964, just the year after, I suppose, or just around the time of le Carré, but a different Berlin for sure.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I chose this book purposely because it is, as you say, an alternative history to exactly the period that we were talking about with Le Carré, that it's set in 1964, but we are in a Cold War, but it's a different Cold War because Hitler had won the war, and so the Cold War is actually between Germany and the United States. But there is a kind of a détente going on between the president, who who's running for re-election in 64 and Hitler. So yes, it's a very different kind of world. I'm not going to give away the twist, but it's fascinating what he does with America and the American president in the context of this alternative history.
I was surprised, however, that an historian like you would choose an alternative history. Surely your academic sensibilities must have been jumping up and down initially, were they?
Well, there are a number of things about that. There has actually been a lot of really interesting academic work done on counterfactual history, alternative history. Neil Ferguson, Andrew Roberts brought out two very good books on that. But, you know, this is a thriller that we listeners are going to be going on this virtual tour to Berlin, not to necessarily think about academic history. They want to be entertained as well. And Robert Harris is one of the most entertaining thriller writers that I know. I think I've probably read all of his books. And I think that one of the things that I like about him and that he does very well in this, which was his first book. I mean, this was his debut novel. He was a political journalist. I think he was the political editor at the Sunday Times at one stage. He'd mainly written non-fictions, but he absolutely hit it out of the park the first time around with this book. And one of the things that I like about it is that he really takes care with the historical details. So actually what he's doing with this book set in 1964 is that he is as well talking about the Holocaust, the Nazi regime, the famous Wannsee conference where the Heydrich initiated the Holocaust and so on. So he really takes care with the historical details. So in the one hand, this is counterfactual, it's an alternative history, but in other ways, he's incredibly careful in making sure that there is this kind of reality or that it's rooted in the reality of what happened.
I suppose that was one of the biggest challenges. It was obviously, he could write an alternative history if he wanted, but he had to deal with the fact that the Holocaust had happened. So in this alternative history, how does he handle, or I suppose, how does he let his characters in Berlin handle the past reality of the Holocaust?
Yeah, I don't want to give away too much of the kind of twists and turns of the thriller, but essentially the Holocaust, although it happened, is not known. So when we start this book, it's been completely kind of pushed not even into the margins of history. It just simply didn't happen. So one of the things that he's doing in this book is, as a police officer in Berlin, he uncovers what looks like a fairly run-of-the-mill crime. He discovers a body in the canal in Berlin. And as he digs into this murder, it kind of becomes apparent that this is kind of part of a cover-up about something. And as the novel goes along, we gradually get to learn more and more about why this murder has taken place and what it means for German history.
What about the physical nature of the Berlin that Harris gives us then? Are we in a place that is, there are a lot more swastikas visible than one might expect, where the goose step is more prevalent than perhaps one might expect or was in reality in the 1960s?
Yeah, and the physical Berlin has been rebuilt along the lines of Speer and the big plans for Berlin to look like Imperial Rome. I mean, so those visions of an imperial city, which we know that Hitler had, have come to pass. And in fact, the novel is set in the days leading up to the 75th birthday of Hitler, So yes, there's a real sense of the kind of everything that you would expect from those kind of rallies. Interestingly, though, in some ways, the most chilling aspect is seeing what has happened to the very young in Berlin. Because, so for example, the main police officer, his child, seeing him deal with his child who has grown up completely within the kind of the Nazi system, is totally indoctrinated. indoctrinated with kind of party ideology and so on. So in some ways, that is almost the most chilling aspect of this.
Final choice that you have for Sen this evening, Richard Aldous, to bring us to Berlin by book. We're going to a very contemporary Berlin, 2009, almost today, if you like, in some ways. The Book of Clouds by Chloe Aridhis. What's the opening scene here, I suppose, really sets the whole book up for us, doesn't it?
Yeah, this is a really lovely book by a Mexican-American writer. And in some ways, it pulls together a lot of the themes that we've already been talking about. That as a young child, she goes with her family to Berlin. And when she's on the subway, she thinks that she sees Hitler disguised as an old woman. And she looks around and she sees that this old woman seems to be surrounded by these burly looking figures who could well be the kind of Praetorian Guard. And kind of, so it kind of plays on that kind of childhood imagination. But then she comes back to Berlin as a student and lives in Berlin for several years. So the book is about her relationship with the city. Obviously, now this is a reunited city. But one of the things that is so wonderful about the book is that she shows how the kind of the contemporary Berlin is so wrapped up with its own sense of history, and how the lifeblood of the city is kind of is its history and dealing with its history, and this very welcoming city having to deal with its dark and complicated past.
What about the Berlin that many of us know in terms of tourism, if we ever get back to the days when we'll be able to travel to cities like Berlin? You know, great nightlife, galleries. It is the essence of cool, really, Berlin, isn't it? The essence of alternative, the essence of progressive. Do we get any sense of that in the Book of Clouds from Aridhis?
Yeah, you know, there is a kind of a sense of the kind of the party life, of kind of what a welcoming, kind of very open city Berlin is. I mean, Berlin traditionally has always been, despite what we sometimes might think, because of it being the kind of the capital during the Second World War and kind of so on, it's always been a very liberal city, very progressive, open-minded city. And yes, you know, that does come through. But there is also what she does so well is to contrast that with the kind of with Germany trying to kind of work out its history, and also the complicated relationship, which I think is still there, actually, and which you see, for example, in the rivalry between the two soccer teams in Berlin, between East and West, that there is still a sense that East Berlin is being reintegrated into the city, or that, perhaps to put it better, that the two sides are integrating themselves into each other, and that has turned out to be quite a complicated relationship. It is worth saying that thinking about kind of Berlin and us going to Berlin, that in the first book that we discussed, The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, that the famous film of that was actually filmed in Dublin.
Yeah,
and they did actually bring it was at Ardmore.
Yeah,
and they did actually build some of the Berlin Wall. I think it was in the Smithfield.
That's precisely
kind of
right.
Smithfield Market. So they're kind of in some ways, we're already 50, whatever it is, years too late in that.
You're in New York. Are you reading New York books? And will you put them in your mind for the next time we want to talk?
I think it's inevitable, isn't it, that what we're going through now will kind of have this kind of, I imagine, creative effect in literature. Mm. But yeah, I've actually found myself rereading the novels of Philip Roth. So I've just read the first two of the Zuckerman books.
Right.
Philip Roth, who is actually kind of buried here at Bard College. Those books really do stand up to the test of time. He's a wonderful, wonderful writer.
All right. That's Richard Aldous there speaking to us briefly at the end about New York. Don't want all his New York ideas just yet. His three Berlin books are The Spy Who Came In From the Cold by John le Carré, Fatherland by Robert Harris, and the final one we spoke about there, The Book of Clouds by Chloe Aridhis. And next Monday, John Banville will be with us, and he will be taking us to Prague. 12 minutes to 8 on Monday night's Arena. The Irish National Opera were all set to perform the Abduction from the Seraglio to audiences in May. However, due to COVID-19, this was not possible. Instead of resting on their laurels, the INO has created a mini-series during lockdown and will now present scenes from Mozart's Seraglio. The opera is sometimes called by the shorter name as well. And those episodes will be seen over 4 weeks, streaming from tomorrow, July the 7th. The mini-series is directed by Katrina McLaughlin, headed by soprano Claudia Boyle, with Peter Whelan conducting the Irish Chamber Orchestra, and is set in modern-day Dublin, where our main character, well, in fact, all the characters find themselves in lockdown. You couldn't make up Katrina, who's, I'm delighted to have you sitting directly opposite me this evening, because we're kind of a little bit out of lockdown now, aren't we?
Absolutely.
Yeah, we're carefully
distanced. We're far away.
We are. But, you know, it's nice. We can see the whites of his other eyes, at least. The Abduction from the Seraglio, in some ways, is the perfect lockdown story of the original.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the original story is three people were kidnapped by pirates and sold and kept in a Seraglio, in a harem or in a palace. Yeah. And then Belmont comes and tries to rescue his wife, or his girlfriend rather. So yeah, so it wasn't a big move to put all the characters locked in and move it online.
Yeah. And Salim, is that how we say, how do we say that? Because there's a kind of a nasty edge to the person we're going to meet early on in this opera.
Yeah, well, it's a funny one. I mean, the opera that we've ended up with is quite different from the original.
Right.
And in the original, there's a character who doesn't sing, and that's the Pasha. That's the guy who is waiting for Claudia Boyle's character to fall in love with him so that, you know, he doesn't have to force her to be his wife. Let's put it like that. So that character is an actor, and he doesn't sing, that character.
Right.
And one of the joys of being able to do it like this is we've got Peter Whelan to play that character in the online version.
Right.
So the conductor, who's the sort of primary artist of any opera, is now the primary character in this.
Yeah, and there is a sense that that's what he's doing. You know, we see him in the opening episode. I'll put a little bit of the overture up just to give us a sense of the music that's involved.
Yeah.
As this is happening, play a little bit and then you can tell me what's happening during it.
Okay.
So what you have, Peter Whelan, who's conducting the piece in reality, he's in his apartment,
yeah,
in lockdown, kind of almost as if he's composing this piece of music.
Yeah, he's composing the whole thing in his mind. It's sort of, you know, a lot of people decided to write a children's book. So what we kind of have done is taken loads of ideas from what people are actually doing during lockdown. Mm. So Peter is trying to write a children's story, and so he's kind of imagining,
right,
both the music and the story, and he's using the things in his immediate environment. Like, we've got lots of little clues to the original opera, so I'll give one away. Like, he starts thinking the original opera, the music at the time, Turkish music was very popular,
yes,
so Mozart was responding to that and adapting a little operetta into this, kind of using Turkish instruments. So he has a Turkish delight on
bar.
The table.
Yeah.
So it's really obvious little things like that,
yeah,
but hopefully it's little hints to the original.
Yeah, but let's listen to this now. Remember, all of the instrumentalists here are in their own homes.
Absolutely.
Miles apart from each other, yet it comes together like this.
It's incredible, isn't it?
It's just extraordinary, the nature of that. So, because that's Peter Whelan. He is conducting the Irish Chamber Orchestra there.
Absolutely.
They, and we see each of them in their various homes, playing either, you know, their instruments, whatever. They play violin. At one stage, the flautist has a big long rest. So she is having a little rice cracker, I think, at
exactly.
one point along the way. Noel Eccles, the percussionist, has very big, important cymbal crash at the beginning. Then he has lots of bars to count. So he's petting his cat,
yeah,
on the sofa. So there's a lot of fun being played with, you know, the nature of the way you're presenting it.
Yeah.
But the technicality, I mean, Fergus Shield was in with us a while back speaking about where they did, you know, when they did the arias with,
oh, yeah,
a piano,
yeah,
and a singer. Here we have a lot of singers and all of the members of the orchestra. Technically very difficult to get that happening when they're in their own homes.
Completely.
Separately.
Yeah, very difficult. I mean, Peter, you know, set, I suppose, a template with the piano and then the lead violinist. So that they, between them, set a kind of tempo. And then each singer, what was great about this is kind of the opposite of what normally happens in an opera. Usually the orchestra, I suppose, would go with the singer, but here kind of the singer had to go with quite a fixed structure.
Yes.
And they each did an amazing job. And then each of the instruments was brought in on top of that. And then Ian Jordan, who's the sound designer, sort of put the whole, all the individual, like in some cases, 30 different pieces of music, layered them on top of each other.
Yeah, and yet it sounds like an orchestra playing in a concert hall. That's what it sounds like. Extraordinary. I watched, obviously, that opening episode with the overture in it. And then I can't stand it. I want to watch all of it now. I want it. Give me more. I want it to be like Netflix. I wanted to binge on it.
Oh, good.
I did get a little bit of episode two. You might tell us, this is the guy now. We have a dating app at play in this, so we're very modern take on abduction from the Seraglio.
Absolutely. Well, trying to figure out what would you do if you were, you know, holding sort of parts of the thread of this original plot together and making everybody sort of in their own home. So, yeah, the character in the original, the character of Osman has... he has been given Blonda as a servant and he's also trying to seduce her. So in this version, he's going through Tinder and he sees her on Tinder and then he tries to get with her.
Yeah.
At least. And then he sees a photo of her with one of his rivals.
Ooh.
And then, yeah. So it's kind of all those little kind of games. It was good fun trying to find the equivalent.
Ways of doing it. Yeah. Well, so this is a Polish-based Wojciech Gierlach who plays the part of Osman. And unfortunately, we don't have the subtitles here, but let's just listen to him first and then I'll let you tell us what he's actually saying here.
Okay. Wer ein Liebchen hat gefunden, wie es treu und redlich meint, nun es mir durch tausend Küsse, mag ihr alle das Leben süße, sei mir Tristen, sei mir Freund, sei mir Tristen, sei mir Freund, sei mir Freund. Tralalera, 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 tralalera.
That's a little section of the Polish-based Wojciech Gierlach from the upcoming Seraglio miniseries. Katrina McLaughlin, who directed the piece, is with me in the studio this evening. I was saying, I was asking you when we were listening to Wojciech there, where was he? He was actually at home in Poland doing that.
He was, yeah.
Coolest apartment in the whole thing, it has to be said.
Yeah,
what I've seen so far.
Absolutely. And, you know, he was really up for it and he kind of, you know, we would send him a shot list and sort of say, you know, we need you to be watching TV or we need you to be on your phone scrolling. And we worked with a company called Together Digital and they were fantastic, you know, supplementing things into the phone. So he would have a green screen on his phone and then they would put images.
Oh, they could put something in on top of it. Yeah, because we have images of some of the orchestra players appearing up in it as well. All sorts of different. And again, it's a fun that you can imagine that he's looking at them and making a decision. Do I want to date her or not? And flicking left or right. I don't know which direction you go, whichever one it is. As you choose. But what he's singing there, how difficult did you find the translate? Because we get, obviously, in the television or in the online version, we get the surtitles. Nicely done, it must be said. And they're not just plonked at the bottom, but kind of appearing as a kind of a drama in themselves.
Yeah. Well, it was kind of difficult to decide how to use them because we're also trying to tell the story through the writing of the story. But here, the idea of the is that the lead character is writing these stories and then these words kind of come in and out of this particular area.
Yeah.
And sometimes they appear on the phone on top of people's faces. So we're trying to connect kind of the lines.
Yeah.
Here he's singing about the fact that, you know, if you fall in love with a woman, you need to hold on to her tight and you need to not, because there tend to be they flitter after every nectar.
Hold on to her tight is a nice way of putting it. Basically what he says is if you fall in love with somebody, lock them up. Yeah. Don't let them out because they'll run off with somebody else. Not the most progressive man, it has to be said, in the world, is he?
No. And you know what? That was one of the gifts of getting to do the opera like this, because it's not the most progressive storyline in general, the original.
There's a little bit of... it's about helping the damsel in distress is kind of what's there. Isn't it? So you're kind of poking fun at that whole idea, I guess.
We are. We were able to turn some of it on its head and, you know...
How many episodes will we get and when can I see them all?
You'll get to see two this week. Yeah. We'll do every Tuesday and Thursday at 6 o'clock for 4 weeks. So Tuesday and Thursday from now on.
Yeah, Tuesday and Thursday,
end of the month.
6 o'clock. So, and they're about, what are they, about 15 minutes
Not
each,
even, some of them. They're about 7, 8, 9 minutes.
Perfect. So you can watch that and you'll still have plenty of time to have your cup of tea and then sit down and turn on the radio. And listen to us at 7 o'clock.
Exactly. Yeah, get a wee Tinder swipe in between.
If you've got the time. And I must say the two episodes that I saw, very excited to see the rest of them. And I hope we will get them all together and be able to binge one night and watch them. That's Catriona McLaughlin there, the director of Seraglio, Irish National Opera's lockdown miniseries. Do check it out. It's well worth looking at, certainly on the basis of the first two that I saw. First episode tomorrow evening, irishnationalopera.ie, 6 o'clock is the time.